the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated.
Well, good afternoon.
We're pleased this afternoon to have with us students from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. On my left are women's studies students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And on my right are pre-law students from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Would they stand, please? And welcome to you all, too. You may be seated. The students are here and have received materials about the case we are about to hear. We have other guests in the courtroom, and we welcome all of you also. If you would like a summary of the case that we are about to hear, please raise your hand, and the deputy marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to understand the case if you're familiar with the facts and with the issue. Good. We're always delighted to welcome students, and we have a program called Court with Class, which we sponsor with the State Bar of Wisconsin. It is a national award-winning program, and that program has been dedicated to high school students around the state. We invite them to attend. We give them the briefs if they agree to attend, and then have a justice speak with them. And today, Justice Bradley spoke with the students who came this morning and to pre-law and women's studies students. Let me introduce the entire court to you all. Starting on my left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, whom you've met. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, who we hope will get elected today, unless there's a large write-in vote. Vote. For those of you old enough, I hope you have voted. For whomever you choose, this is not persuasive message other than to vote. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductory remarks stated, let me call what was to be the third case, but because of circumstances beyond our control, is the only case today, 04AP3384, Bernice Spiegelberg versus State and Department of Transportation. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Robert Hunter. Counsel, Mr. Hunter.
May it please the Court. My name is Robert Hunter. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I appear today on behalf of the appellant, Wisconsin Department of Transportation. The action before the Court involves a construction application of the statutes governing eminent domain, specifically with Stat 32.096. As this Court is aware, whenever private property is taken by eminent domain, the state must pay the private owner just compensation. Whereas here, the taking is less than the entirety of the property, 32.096 specifically defines just compensation to be the sum determined by deducting from the fair market value of the whole of the property immediately before the date of valuation, the fair market value of the remainder immediately after the date of valuation. How do we determine what the fair market value of the property is? We get appraisals, which estimate how much a willing buyer, not forced to buy, would pay to a willing seller, not forced to sell that property. 32096 demands that we get two appraisals, contemplating two essentially simultaneous transactions. It asks, what was the value of the whole property immediately before the transfer, and what was the value of the remainder immediately after? These appraisals must value the subject property as if it were being sold as a whole on the date of the taking.
Mr. Hunter, is there any limitation on that as a whole? Here we're talking, as in your brief, you're talking about a 150-acre farm, and farms vary. Some have lowland, highland, woods, whatever. So you're saying that what if this was a 500-acre farm and you were putting the highway where the highway was going through the farmland, but half of the farm was marshland and half of the farm was highland? Would that make any difference as far as the unit rule?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The essence, Your Honor, of the unit rule, or what would happen is that would come out essentially in the wash, as it were. Assuming part of the property has a more contributory value to the whole, as it were, so that it's more usable agriculturally, for development later on or whatever, the before and after takes that into account. If DOT takes the bottom land, that has very little contributory value as a farm. So if you net that out, which is essentially what the statute requires, it really doesn't matter whether...
Your argument sounds good, but I don't think under our environmental laws that the highway would want to be going through these marsh areas. In fact, I know they wouldn't. So I guess the point that I'm making or asking is that as far as fair value, and you're talking about fair value to the person who against eminent domain is being used, how is this fair market value when you have these, my example is different uses of the land or the woods, the stream, and the fields, and you say, well, that comes out in the wash. And I don't quite see how it comes out in the wash.
Your Honor, essentially what happens is if all of the property is properly valued before the sale, say it's valued at $100,000 or $1 million or whatever, nice round numbers, and DOT takes property, and it doesn't matter what kind, if you want it to take higher value property or lower value property, it doesn't matter. The value of that property remaining, assuming that property is the higher value property, would stay with the owner. If it's the lower value property, that would also, you know, if DOT takes the lower value property, that would go away from the owner. If DOT takes the higher value property, that would go with DOT, and the lower value would go with the owner. That valuation, that contribution of value to the after, to the remainder, is what really is determined by the before and after. So it comes out in the wash in that it doesn't really matter which part I take. When you subtract it out, you end up with whatever the value of the property is as remaining.
All right. Here, and I don't want to... Here you have five parcels, five tax parcels. You're going through, without looking at the map, I think parcel two and three.
Yes, Your Honor.
But there are five parcels that this person, the Spiegelbergs, could sell without having any further... In other words, it's a tax parcel, could be sold anyway. And you're going through two of the five parcels.
Yeah, essentially, there are probably some little bits and pieces that's more or less true. It's actually, I think, three parcels that were being...
Yes, it goes, the road swings around and touches another one.
Yes, Your Honor.
But those parcels are individual to the landowner or the owner. He or she could sell these without having any further, needing any further permits or anything. So why would they be considered as a whole? Simply because you own all of them.
Your Honor, first of all, there is no evidence in the record, as far as I'm aware, that would support a determination by the court, or by this court, or by the trial court, that the parcels needed no further permits. It's true that the properties could be sold theoretically.
Yeah, I'm just saying I'm not talking about development. I'm talking about just being able at an arm's length to sell parcel 1, 2, 3, or 4, or 5 to somebody that wanted to buy that specific parcel, that tax key number.
Yeah, the tax key number, as far as I'm aware, really doesn't mean anything per se with regard to the property. It is a methodology which is developed by, as far as I'm aware, the appraiser, not the appraiser, the assessor, for purposes of identifying the property. If this court were to make a determination, or if the trial court were to make a determination that that assessor's designation of this property is essentially finite for purposes of valuing the property, as would be the case here, then it would also be appropriate for the assessor's assessment to be valuable for the court to consider. And I don't believe that that's the law here.
Well, okay. Then my last question is, so two different owners. If you had, if parcel 2 and parcel 3 were owned differently, in other words, there were two or three different owners, would they get different prices then as far as the appraisal, in other words, the eminent domain?
In other words, if
A owned parcel 2 and B owned parcel 3, 4, and 5, then you would be looking at 3, 4, and 5 as a unit, but you'd only be looking at the value of 2 because just one person owned that, right?
I guess I'm having trouble.
No, the trouble is that I'm having is that you're basing the value on the whole that someone may own rather than the value of the particular property. See what I mean?
Your Honor, my understanding of the unit rule is this, and it essentially goes to, for lack of a better example, a ream of paper. Okay. If I were to buy a ream of paper, I would pay, say, a dollar for 1,000 sheets of paper or something like that. The essence of the unit rule is that if you have a ream of paper, DOT pays for the one sheet of paper that it buys. It doesn't pay for, say, the fair market value of what would be a one piece of paper. Or it doesn't pay the cost of what one would charge for one sheet of paper, but rather for what one piece of a ream of paper is worth.
I guess that's my point. If a person owns more than one sheet of paper, let's say number 2 is one sheet of paper, and number 3, 4, and 5 are more than that, then you are assessing, I'm talking about fair market value, you're cutting across the board differently. In other words, you're giving different values. That's what I don't understand.
Now, Your Honor, as I understand the way the rules to operate under 3209, the before and after, essentially, where one person, and we're talking about one person here, where one owner owns the property and is using it for the same purpose, and it's a contiguous property, although there are cases which go either way about that.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's being used for the same purpose, then essentially it's all considered to be one piece of paper or one ream of paper. And the department is required to pay fair compensation for the piece, the one sheet of paper that it buys, which is a proportion of that entire dollar, as it were, not to pay for a price of that paper for the one sheet of paper, which would be as much as the market would bear for one single sheet of paper.
Counselor, what if the day before the condemnation proceeding, one of the Spielbergs gave parcel 2 and 3, and I'm going from north being 1, next south is 2, next south is 3. So they deeded parcel 2 to one kid and parcel 3 to another kid. Aren't you going to have to determine individual effects on those parcels at the time of condemnation?
Your Honor, the question would then be whether or not they could actually proceed with the taking based on an individual owner. They would have, theoretically at least, there should be 3 individual takings from 3 individual people.
Well, certainly there would be. I agree with that. That wasn't my question. And my question goes, how do you value this same piece of real estate given that it's now owned by two children and the parents still own parcel number one?
Your Honor, my understanding is that, assuming that there are no contracts among the parties, that the uses are no longer the same for the parcel, that it's not being used as a unitary use.
Well, just say the use is the same. I understand that the parents live on parcel one and the rest is farmed, but not by the people who own parcel one, two, three, four, and five, by someone else. So we'll just say the same people own it, and they deeded it to their kids because they were just doing a little estate planning. And where does that put DOT in regard to valuation?
Well, the assumption would be, Your Honor, that if the property is still being used for the same purpose, essentially by the same people,
yeah,
it should theoretically run out to be the same.
So you're saying if it's owned by three different people, you're going to take it as a contiguous piece of land just because it's all used for farming?
No, the question which you posed was that it is continually being used by the same, essentially, people for the same essential purpose.
But they're tenants. They don't own it. They just rent it out.
To the extent that the provisions of Chapter 32 apply, as far as I'm aware, what it requires is that where there is a single owner.
Oh, but we're taking that out of the mix in my hypothetical.
Well, then, Your Honor, you would have to also add to the mix that DOT would then have to issue several different takings. There would be several different jurisdictional.
I guess I'm not doing a good job of trying to get across my point. We have very specific pieces of real estate that are being taken. Today they're owned by one person, and they are used in accord with that person's wishes. My hypothetical says you have the same physical pieces of real estate. Now they're owned by three people, but they're used by exactly the same people. So the legal ownership has changed. Use has not changed, and the physical property has not changed. I understand there have to be separate takings, but I just want to ask you about how you would value each part within those takings. Would you think that it'd still be the same rule?
Well, Your Honor, I believe in Radiman there was something more or less along that line that happened. And for whatever reason, it went to the single taking. And, yes, that's what happened, that there was one taking, there was one essential chunk of property with multiple owners. Whether or not it should have been that way, that's not for me to say. But that's what happened. Under that case, the parties did not let's see, there was a question in terms of 3205, I believe, in compliance with that requirement, the requirement there that the parties were supposed to object to the taking, the form of the taking, and they did not. Consequently, at the hearing, at trial, when there was a motion to break up, bifurcate the trial based on the different parcels that were involved, the trial court refused, saying that 3205 was not complied with because time had expired for them doing so. Even though there were multiple owners of property involved, there was one taking.
Do you look then at what is the economic interest now for that property? Is that what you are assessing or not assessing?
No, what we're looking at is the current use of property.
That's what I mean by what is the current use of the property, what's the current economic use of the property.
Yes, Your Honor. If the property is being used as an economic whole, as a single unit for one purpose by essentially one owner, then essentially what happens is the value of the property is to be determined based on how many acres you have. It's not necessarily that it's a percentage sort of thing. Because, as I said before, if you have better chunks of property and worse chunks of property, depending on which chunk of property DOT would take, the remainder is then the value is either increased or decreased based on what's left. What did the owner keep in the remainder?
Which, following up on Justice Bradley, it seems to me that under subsection 2, we're defining just compensation. And it seems to me that would apply whether all or part of the property is taken. Do we agree on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And subsection 2 says, in determining just compensation, the property sought to be condemned shall be considered on the basis of its most advantageous use, but in terms of the use affecting present market value. And the general rule, at least as I understand it, and my limited knowledge of condemnation, is what you're really trying to do is say, look, this is a forced sale by the state. But what we really want to find out is fair market value. And fair market value means that which a willing buyer and a willing seller would ultimately agree on, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So it's, and another factor I'm going to put in is that this tax parcels are for purposes of assessment. And I said I did a Westlaw search, and that's what it's, the cases seem to say. I haven't read all of the cases fully, but that tax parcels are for assessment. Now, they may have a use in zoning or not. I don't know. That doesn't seem to be an issue in this case as such, because I think they're all zoned the same or substantially the same. It's ag now and could be used for residential, although the lot sizes may differ if I understand the facts. Now, if there were a willing buyer and a willing seller for all five of these parcels, or parts thereof, which is what you're doing, but we have to figure out the total value, then take the total value of what the state's taking, right? And we make a subtraction.
Yeah, actually, Your Honor, you do it the other way around.
Okay.
Yeah, you take the total value of everything that they had,
right,
and take the total value of everything that they have left,
yeah,
and then the difference is the value of the state's taking. Yes.
So on the total value that they have, and if there was a willing buyer and a willing seller, and I was the willing buyer, I would not look at this as five separate parcels with present agricultural use. I would say, if this is true, I would say, in a very short time, this can be changed from agriculture to residential. Indeed, the neighboring units are already developing that way. Therefore, when I buy it, my fair market value that I'm willing to pay as a reasonable buyer with a knowledgeable, reasonable seller is the value of these five parcels as within a short time. I think that's the kicker I'm trying to point out. Residential. And if the state takes these pieces for highway, then some of these parcels are going to have a reduced value as residential, at least according to the appraiser in the appendix.
That would be disputed, Your Honor, but in any event.
That's the next question I'm going to ask you. For the appraisers, it's a 234 in the appendix, as I read it. I would not say I'm going to buy parcel 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 as agricultural use, if I'm right about the facts. I would say it's agricultural use and buy it at that if there was a long time in coming before I can develop this land.
Right.
And it seems to me that the overriding issue here is not whether it's five parcels or one unit, but what would a buyer at fair market value do as to all of this land, the whole property, which is how I get around or get into six.
I believe, Your Honor, you're exactly correct.
So why isn't the condemnee right here then?
Well, there are two things about that.
I'm right. Okay.
And I would point to, as the Court was in the appendix, I would point to AP 251, the appellant's appendix on page 251.
Okay.
It gives an example of exactly this situation by happenstance. It's their appendix. It was their appraisal.
Okay.
And the essence of it is the property was purchased by Carol Turner. I will quote.
Right.
An example is the property purchased by Carol A. Turner.
It's the first full paragraph at 251. Got it.
Turner. This farm was comprised of 118 acres.
Mm-hmm.
A farmstead. Ms. Turner paid $285,000 for it. the whole parcel, in February of 2000. Then she sold the farm, said, with 58 acres for $345,000. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it doesn't say when that occurred. Okay. She split off the balance of the acres.
But you assume it's between the time she bought it in 2003, because it's then. Okay, go ahead.
Then she sold off the farm, said, splitting off the balance of the acreage. Then she sold a 19-acre parcel in July of 2003 for $81,000. In June of 2003, she sold another 19-acre parcel for $92,000. She sold another parcel, that being a 10-acre parcel, in April of 2002. And lastly, she sold an 8-acre parcel in April of 2002. The problem, Your Honor, is simply this. Ms. Turner is not Mrs. Spiegelberg.
Pardon me?
Ms. Turner is not Mrs. Spiegelberg. Ms. Spiegelberg is in the position of essentially the state in this context, as it were. The acquisition under 3209 requires present-day, immediate, simultaneous transfers. Mm-hmm. That's what's contemplated. What you're looking at here took place over a course of 3 years.
Mr. Hunter, what is our standard of review in this proceeding?
Your Honor?
What is our standard of review?
It would be a de novo review.
This is de novo? It's not clearly erroneous?
In terms of the standard, it's a question of law determined by the trial court. I believe it's a de novo review.
And the reason I ask is I'm wondering how sub 8 under 3209 interplays here. You have a proceeding, you have a court that can have both parties submit additional evidence, and it makes a determination based on that evidence, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't that what we have here?
Your Honor, the parties desired to submit evidence. The trial court made a ruling, which essentially made the evidence irrelevant. There was no evidence that the department could put on relative to the methodology. To the specifics of the determination by the trial court as to what was required as a jury in a special verdict. And the fact that there was no evidence rendered it impossible for the department to proceed.
Well, you submitted your appraisal and what you thought was your best the best use, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. In what form did you do that?
Your Honor?
In what form did you submit that to the trial court?
It was an offer of proof, Your Honor.
Okay. And the condemnee made an offer of proof.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they talked about the highest and best use, the applicable zoning, comparable land, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Severance damages, if any. Were there any severance damages?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was stated in your offer of proof?
Yeah, all things were contained in the offer, Your Honor.
Maps, pictures, cost of reproduction, capitalization, et cetera. You were ready to go to jury trial as to the value, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The trial court determined that this was not to be handled as a unit.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that the condemnee's jury instructions and the condemnee's version of how this should be valued was accepted by the trial court. You lost.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so the trial court was left with, you were left with, if you went to the jury, you'd lose.
Yes.
Why didn't you put in evidence? Well, let me just double back. Now, if you should win here, does that mean we have to take your value at of the property, or does it go back to give the other side a chance to challenge your valuation?
Your Honor,
put in its own value.
Your Honor, the way that it was left by stipulation of parties was that if we win, then it goes back for a consideration of
the state wins, right?
If the state wins, it goes back to the trial court for a consideration of an element of proof which was not reached by the trial court, specifically with regard to the parcel taken as a whole, as a separate taking.
So that your appraisal value just doesn't become the rule in this case.
Right.
What happens if the if the condemnee wins?
Then the value is as stated, and we go forward. Essentially, DOT has to cut the check.
You don't want to put in any evidence contrary to the condemnee?
Your Honor, there is no evidence to put in. The department drafted its
jurisdictional offer.
It drafted its jurisdictional offer. It prepared its essential appraisals based on the concept of the unit rule,
mm-hmm.
that this is a 150-acre parcel.
Mm-hmm.
It had no evidence to present at the time for trial.
Well, don't you have now, if you lose on the law, don't you have evidence you could present?
We have evidence to present, Your Honor, or we would have to go back and to get a new appraisal done.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, whether that could be done or not, it's a question as to the court's order.
Well, have you stipulated away that opportunity?
That was what was stipulated at the hearing.
Where is the stipulation in the appendix?
It's in the, I don't believe it's in the record, Your Honor. Or it's not in the
material. It is. It's at 104 and 5 and 6 and 7.
Got it. Thank you.
Counselor,
I have one quick question because I want to be sure I didn't misunderstand your answer to my question, especially when you brought up Radiman and I went back and read it. And just so I'm clear, I think I understand what you mean, but just so I'm clear, there were two owners for three parcels in Radiman, and the trial court ruled they could be considered as one parcel that was appealed, and the Court of Appeals said you had to raise that under 3205 because it was jurisdictional to have separate offers to two people. So the court never concluded that, in fact, it was proper to treat three parcels that were owned by two different people as one parcel. It was just that it wasn't timely raised. Is that right?
That's more or less how it seems, Your Honor. I'm not sure the exact basis of the underlying ruling.
Okay. Thank you.
Chief, if I may.
Go ahead. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Hunter, we're talking about a property consisting of 150 acres. We have five people sitting over there next to the wall. If the gentleman with the gray hair owned all 150 acres, and you took 11 plus acres from that, you say that that the correct loss or diminution of value is $18,900?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But if all five of them owned this land, the five different parcels, and the same 11 plus acres was taken, then it's not irrational at all to say that the damages are $84,600. Is that right?
That could be possible, Your Honor. The result essentially is that that would be predicated on there being five separate owners and five separate larger parcel determinations. The issue which the Court must recall here is that there is not at any point anywhere within the defendant's or the plaintiff's documentation or her briefs, et cetera, any contention that she doesn't own 150 acres. We're not really arguing about the larger parcel. We're not arguing about what is the larger parcel. What we're arguing about is whether or not she has to sell it based on, or she has the opportunity of having simultaneous smaller sales or one sale of the entire parcel, the whole of the parcel.
But it doesn't seem rational to me. The land is exactly the same. And you're going to get 11 acres of that land. And it seems to me the value of the land, the fair market value of the land, should not fluctuate so dramatically depending on whether there are five owners or one owner.
Your Honor, I didn't write the statutes. And the way that this is drafted and the way that the law has developed is that where there is one owner, that owner is paid essentially based on the number of acres that he or she has in comparison to the entire whole. The value of that acreage is determined by how much land that owner has. Where there are multiple owners and smaller acreages, there is, therefore, yes, an increased value. The records, the briefs are replete with documentation with references to determinations by the courts and learned opinions that where there is more acreage, essentially a rule of size regression applies in real estate. Where you have a hole, the size of the purchase, the acquisition cannot, by breaking it down, you cannot increase the value of the whole greater than the sum of the parts, or the other way around, that the value of the whole can never be exceeded by the summation of its parts.
Well, those cases, at least I read some of them, not all of them, dealt with where you have separate owners and separate types of property, like the land and maybe someone else owned fixtures or the leasehold. You looked at the property as a whole to get the full value and then separated it out among the various owners of the parts thereof. At least that's the way it started. Do you disagree with that?
No, Your Honor, but I think that
And it got stretched out in other cases.
Well, what you have to take from that, Your Honor, is the essence that there is an infinite variety of ways that people can structure bits and pieces of land.
Mm-hmm.
Ownership of land comes, especially we're talking about 150, 200-acre parcels. This area was surveyed in the 1830s or 40s or 50s or whatever. Over the course of time, lands have been bought and sold countless times. And so in order to essentially amass a farm of 150 acres, you buy bits and pieces. The value of, or the existence of a separate document, whether it's a legal description or a tax parcel, that has no relationship whatsoever, really, to the actual value of that land.
Mm-hmm.
It's all been used as the farm. That's what it's valued as.
Is your objection that in the near future it will not be developed?
Your Honor, my objection...
That's totally speculative. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. My objection is that if the Court turns to the portion I read before relating to Carol Turner, the whole problem there is that what did Ms. Turner do?
Mm-hmm.
What happened? She bought the property from someone. 400. She bought the whole property.
Yeah, but within 3 years, and some of these sales were within 1 or 2 years, it appears.
Possibly, Your Honor.
Okay. Is 3 years too long? Is that the point? I mean, there are different theories here. One is it isn't short-term enough. It's speculative. Forget it. Another is you got to do the unity, which has nothing to do with the first argument. So which is your argument, or is it both?
Well, it's both, Your Honor. And the reason for it is this, essentially. At least in terms of the Carol Turner analogy, the difficulty is that the court has no information as to how much it cost her to subdivide the land, how much it cost her to put in roads, the cost of money that she bore. Did she have to get the land perked, essentially, find out whether or not it could be used for septic fields or streets being put in. How is access actually going to be provided to the property?
And that all goes to the fair market value between a buyer and a seller. A buyer takes all that into consideration and comes up with a number.
But, Your Honor, that's speculation in terms of the long term of this property. 3209 says what you're contemplating is a sale right now of all the property right here, and then you turn around and whatever's left is also being sold to calculate the value.
I have another question. 8107 is a jury instruction. I think you cite it in your brief, where there's a unity of use, two or more parcels. And so it goes to the jury. And yet, a comment says, ordinarily the question whether two or more parcels constitute one tract, that's only for severance damages, is that right, is a question for the court and not the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure exactly.
What does it all mean?
What to make of that, Your Honor. I had to pass. I just read it. I don't write it. I think that the essence of that, however, is that the court is determined what is required here is that where there is a determination to be made as to what is a larger parcel,
mm-hmm.
where there is unity of use, okay. ownership, and operation, et cetera,
that's what the jury
that's for the jury to determine.
Okay. I have one final question. I don't understand the stipulation. It says, if upon final appeal, it is determined insufficient facts exist to establish correct jury instructions and special verdicts, the matter will be remanded. Do you think there are insufficient facts here?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me just follow up. I understood your brief to say if an owner of the land wishes to assert that the land being taken is not at the present time being used as its highest potential, then it's incumbent upon the owner to establish this fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's exactly what I thought you were talking about with regard to what the Chief read, which is on the bottom of page 3 of the stipulation. I mean, I sit here listening to these arguments, and it seems to me that, and I'll ask your opposing counsel, but it seems to me that at least you're advancing that the use now is farming. Okay. And that consistent with sub 2 of 3209, what you're looking for is the most advantageous use for it to get the value.
Yes.
So if the owner is asserting that there is a use other than the present use, which is more advantageous, then the owner has to show that there's a more advantageous use than the present use.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the owner have an opportunity to show that here?
Your Honor, there was no trial, and the court made a determination essentially as a matter of law.
And what did that court make the determination on as a matter of law? What was the rationale of the court? The issue was whether or not to deny your motion in limine. That was the issue that's appealed from here.
Yes,
but what's the rationale of the court?
The rationale of the trial court, Your Honor, I believe you're asking the wrong person for that one.
Didn't you read the record?
Yes, I read the record, Your Honor.
Now let me refer to page 8 of the transcript on August 30th, 2004. And this is the rationale. He says, I'm going to deny the motion in limine. Separate tax parcels, certified survey maps, that seems to be, I had a case just similar. I had a jury trial not that long ago. I guess it wasn't similar. Cut through one parcel. But I agree with you, Mr. Beersdorf, not preclude you from arguing that, presenting evidence as to each parcel and diminution of value before the taking, obviously after the taking. So I'm going to deny the motion. Then on page 11 he continues because he has to put some more rationale into his opinion because that's it. He says a little later, essentially I just wanted to make part of the record. I see no distinguishing traits of a certified survey map versus a separate tax parcel. That I understood to be the rationale of his, the basis of his opinion, because I couldn't find anything else that was.
Your Honor, you did better than I did in terms of finding the rationale.
Thank you.
So what do we do with it?
Your Honor?
The rationale. How do we deal with it when there's no trial court or limited trial court rationale?
Your Honor, my suggestion is that the court should look at the record and the arguments of counsel made. And I believe it's fairly clear that there was not an opportunity to provide evidence on the essential question which is required here, namely, but what is the value of the whole of the property? Under 32096, that's required. What it specifies and what I believe BISNA, I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation of the case, says is that there are essentially two questions the jury is supposed to answer. What's the before and what's the after? What's the value of the whole property before? What's the value of the remainder after? That's not what was asked here. And I think that that is what is required. Under the stipulation, The plaintiff has essentially stipulated that they didn't have any evidence to provide relative to what was the whole value of the property. They recognize that they did not calculate that. Their appraisal was not directed in that manner, was not prepared in that fashion. We recognize that we didn't have our appraisal prepared to deal with the properties as separate individual bits. That, I believe, is not was an improper methodology in any event, but there was not any evidence that the department could present at that point in time relative to what were the values of the individual legal parcels. Or, sorry, they weren't legal parcels, they were tax parcels.
A certified survey and a tax parcel, you say, are not legal parcels. You're saying that's what your position is.
Your Honor, I don't know what a certified survey map connotes.
Well, it connotes that they surveyed it, they certified it, and they filed it in the courthouse. So if you go to find that parcel, it's in the courthouse. So if you ask for certified survey map 1, you can go in the courthouse and see what it is, and that's recorded.
And that really doesn't mean anything in terms of the value of the property, Your Honor. The question is, does the survey map mean anything in terms of value? The answer is no, it doesn't.
Tells you where the lot lines are.
Well, it tells you where the lot lines are, but that really doesn't mean much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Hunter.
Your Honor.
You will have a few moments in rebuttal. Mr. Beersdorf, Attorney Beersdorf, representing Bernice Spiegelberg.
Honored members of the court, respected counsel, my name is Dan Beersdorf, and I am here representing Bernice Spiegelberg, the plaintiff in the circuit court and the respondent in this court. I wish to start out by just disagreeing with respected counsel on one point. I indicated that we're not in disagreement about the larger parcel. I'm here to say we are in disagreement about the larger parcel. That is what this case is about. How do we determine the larger parcel in situations like this? I also want to have the opportunity today to clarify, or I hope, explain to the court, so I hope the court will clarify two areas of law that I think have been confused, and one is misstated currently on the record. The first one is the unit rule. This case is not about the unit rule. Not about the unit rule. What is the unit rule? The unit rule involves a single parcel that has multiple interests of ownership in it. The classic example, the fee owner owns the land. A tenant, such as a convenience store gasoline operator, executes a long-term lease and builds and constructs and owns the improvements. If you look at the classic unit rule cases, they will tell you that you do not value the interest of the tenant, improvement owner, separately from the ownership interest of the underlying fee owner of the land.
But don't the later cases go a little further than that?
Pardon?
Don't the later cases go a little further than that?
That's the problem. They go further,
But the genesis is what you just said.
Yeah, what I'm saying, that's the genesis, and it basically, the underlying rule for the unit rule is you have a single parcel with multiple ownership interests. Usually it's two. What we have here are multiple parcels under a single ownership interest. So we do not have the classic definition of the unit rule. Now, if this court chooses to say that the unit rule is going to be more than the classic definition, that's fine. But I believe that there is confusion in the cases as I read them as they came up, that I saw the classic definitions and I saw others that confused them, and I hope the court will take this opportunity to clarify, and I believe and I hope, enunciate the unit rule as I understand it to be, the classic one where it is a single parcel involving multiple owners and does not address the situation of multiple parcels under a single ownership.
What do we mean by parcels? Do you mean tax parcels? Do you mean lots?
Whatever it happens to be in that particular case. Obviously, in our case here, we're talking about tax parcels. So in this particular case, the unit rule would apply, for instance, if on one of the tax parcels, well, just take parcel number 1, where the buildings are located. If Bernice Spiegelberg only owned the land and someone else had constructed and owned the improvements, then the unit rule would come into play where you would value the whole parcel as a whole and then subdivide it between the interests rather than valuing the interests of the separate interests themselves and adding them together to get the whole.
Also, just so I asked opposing counsel the question of, we talked about a certified surveyor. It was mentioned in this case there was a tax parcel.
Right.
Was there also a certified survey? Was it?
In this particular case, we only have tax parcels.
Okay, so
we include examples of
survey. Your example was a certified survey, but the only breakdown of this property, breakdown meaning of the five parcels, state wants to talk about one parcel, you want to talk about five.
Right.
And your only division is the fact that it's taxed in five different it's taxed in five different bills, five different tax bills.
Well, there's five actually five different legal descriptions.
Five different legal descriptions.
That is correct. Right. Now, that's the legal separation. One thing that the Spiegelberg case presents to the court for consideration, because I'm assuming that this court is looking at some kind of a, quote, general rule, is that we have different uses involved in the parcels, and I'll just take a moment here. I'm going to put on a screen. My technological prowess is coming through here.
It's a little blurry. It's a little blurry. Yeah.
I've got to adjust my eyes just a minute.
Well, what is it?
Okay, put it back on.
That's okay.
That's fine.
That's good.
Whatever you did.
Whatever I did.
Great.
Your Honors, what I'm showing you is page 17 of Appraisal Group 1 appraisal, which was the appraisal that was completed on behalf of Bernice Spiegelberg, the respondent. And you'll notice that this this addresses the highest and best use issue before the taking, where Mr. Kielish addresses parcels 1 to 3 and indicates, after explaining about the development that's going on in the neighborhood, that parcels 1 through 3 lend themselves to a development use, whereas parcels 4 and 5 are covered by a wetland district overlay and therefore have basically a different use than the other, than the first three.
Now, I asked opposing counsel that. I said, and I tried to, and perhaps I wasn't clear about the different, the uses of this. They're saying agricultural, but you have, in your argument as well, possible development in 1, 2, and 3. But at least when you value the whole parcel, parcels 4 and 5, is talking about a wetland.
Right.
And that would be at least what I was trying to convey, was that may have a less value, a wetland, as far as compared to something that could be developed.
Yes, and I believe that's how the analysis came out in this particular appraisal report, is that it did have a less or a lower value per acre than the per acre value for the other parcels.
Well, how could the argument then be that when you take this as a whole, it's a wash and it comes out the same?
Well, it's not really a wash. They won't come out the same, because the problem is that what we're talking about here by determining a larger parcel is what are the comparables that you're using. Because when you're doing it as in the way that the state is arguing, you're really talking about comparable sales that have 150 acres or thereabouts of land area. And the parcels that the respondent plaintiff we're talking about, except for the wetland parcels, which were 40 and 20 acres, the others were between, I think, 20 and 30 acres, if I'm not mistaken. The point being is there is a maxim in real estate. I think it's one that's pretty well recognized, that as you decrease the size of a parcel of land, it's going to sell for more for a parcel of more per unitary acreage. And that's exactly what you have here. That's why you're not going to have a wash, because in effect the wetlands, which in this case represented 60 acres, goes in, gets attached to the other three parcels, and it creates much larger parcels, which when you look in the marketplace for comparables represent a much lower value per acre than if you're dealing with smaller ones.
Counsel, this is interesting, and to me the words that you have bolded, that parcel 1 to 3 lend themselves, of course, means that parcel 1 to 3 isn't quite there yet, but lend themselves to such a development purpose with road frontage. You know, it's just coming around the bend. You know, it lends themselves. Problem I have is this, and you hit the problem on the nail in your brief on page 26. That is, the trial court ruled only addressed at the hearing what the existing use was.
Well, I don't even know if they looked at the existing use. You asked the question earlier, what was the judge's rationale? I think the rationale was he just felt that CSMs and tax buses were the same. That was the end of his inquiry.
Yeah, just like what I read. I mean, I read the sum and complete total. That was on page 8 and that little end on page 11 is the rationale.
That was his inquiry.
Yeah. And so you say on page 26, and I agree based on what we just said, the only thing addressed at the hearing was the existing use. The trial court was obviously not concerned about this issue, the issue of what's coming around the bend, what's the most reasonable use, since it reached its ruling without making any inquiry about the most advantageous use. And then I'll skip a sentence, and it says, in the event this court, though, believes that a ruling on the issue requires an inquiry into the most advantageous use for subject property, then this case will need to be remanded to the trial court for testimony on that issue. I mean, it seems to me as I'm sitting here, I'm returning to those thrilling days when I was a circuit court judge, because you are arguing here about what's the most advantageous use. You are arguing to me what the trial court should have been hearing.
Yep. I mean, he never got that far.
But didn't your appraisal come in on the most advantageous use?
Oh, yes, it did.
Didn't he accept your $84,000?
Yeah, oh, yeah, he did accept it. I'm just saying he never...
Are you complaining?
No, pardon?
Are you complaining?
No, I'm not.
All right.
I'm trying to answer the question.
I understand, but in effect, you put in the most advantageous. That's what your appraisal said.
Right.
It can be challenged on the basis that Justice Bradley just said, because there's no time period here. It's not...
No.
1 year, 2 years, 10 years, right? Okay.
That's exactly correct. The reason that the appraiser realized that was because there's a development immediately along the road, as he recognized there, and it's not like anyone has a crystal ball. The problem we have in any eminent domain case is we're always dealing with a hypothetical sale, because the property that's being taken wasn't sold.
Right.
We don't have that situation, so...
Let's pretend.
Pardon?
It's a let's pretend.
Yes, it is. Exactly.
Kavanaugh, okay, a second question for you. You said there were two areas of the law that needed clarification. One was the unit rule. If you gave me the second one,
The second one is the ruling in Raderman.
Okay.
I'd like to just explain to you, Raderman, what Raderman says is, and the state argued that we didn't comply with Raderman, but I want to deal with Raderman on two levels. Before I do, I just want to just set as a backdrop, what is an eminent domain case? You have to appreciate that an eminent domain case has two phases to it. The first phase is what we call the takings phase. This one has received a lot of publicity lately because of the Kelo decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's the absolute power to take or not.
Exactly.
Okay. We're not fighting here.
No, we're not. That's the first phase. The second phase of an eminent domain case is what we call the damages phase, where we determine just compensation.
All right.
So you must remember, those are our two phases that we're dealing with. What the Raderman court said was, if you look at it closely, is they say, we got to look at our case in determining whether to apply 32.05, we need to determine whether or not the issue involves compensation. If it involves compensation, then we proceed. If it doesn't involve compensation, we have to do it in a separate action under 32.05. In other words, according to Raderman, the initial inquiry that's made is whether or not the issue involved is compensation. That's not what 32.05 says.
Well, 32.05 divides it up between compensation and other objections.
I'm going to put, hopefully this will show up here. I've highlighted here Section 3205. The introductory phrase for 3205 says as follows. If an owner desires to contest the right of the condemnor to condemn the property described in the jurisdictional offer, then we go on and you have to...
It says for any reason other than the amount of compensation.
Exactly. Exactly.
Then the 3205 applies, but doesn't apply if it's a compensation, because that's handled separately.
Exactly. Now, the point is what the court did is the court focused on the clause for any reason other than the amount of compensation offered is inadequate. We look at 3205, it's kind of like there's a door to 3205. And what's the instruction on the door to walk in and utilize its provisions? The instruction on the door says we only go to 3205 if there is a challenge to the taking. That's the only time the 3205 comes into play. That's not what Raderman said. Raderman said, let's look to see if there's a valuation issue. If it's not a valuation issue, we go to 3205. But that's not what this statute says. This statute says we only go to 3205 when there's a challenge to the taking. And why is this significant? 3205 addresses this two-phase component of an eminent domain case, the takings phase and the damages phase.
Suppose the jurisdictional offer is no good because, well, we had a case where the jurisdictional offer had a defect in terms of it didn't state the date of possession. It came under 3205-5.
It could come under that.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is, and the court there held that that was a contest under 3205. That's what it meant, contest the right of the condemnor to condemn the property, because the jurisdictional offer wasn't good. Didn't mean that they couldn't ever do it, but they goofed.
I don't think a jurisdictional question like that is limited to a 40-day appeal. If the jurisdictional...
The statute says if you didn't do it in the 40 days, you waived it. That's what the statute says.
But the only thing that I think you waive in the 40 days is if you don't challenge the taking, the right to take. Now, it could be argued, and I don't have the case in front of you you're thinking of, but it might be that the jurisdictional requirements to perfect your taking might be a right to take, and therefore that would be appropriate here. But
why is this important? I never thought of 3205 as playing a role in this case. Neither of you cited it in your brief, so why are we doing this?
Well, it was cited by the state.
In pages 10 and 11, which you're challenging.
By brief.
Yes, that's the Raderman part that you're challenging, if I understood your motion.
Yes.
It's not okay. I see that. It's not in their statute of authorities.
It did not arise until the reply brief to this court at the very end. So okay. Otherwise, I would agree with you, Your Honor. We did not believe it had anything to do with this case, but since the state brought it up, and if the state feels it's important, if this court feels it's important, I believe that the Raderman ruling should be clarified, because clearly the switch or the door to 3205 is whether or not there's a challenge to the taking. That is the underlying basis for 3205 to even come into play. If you aren't challenging the taking, then the reason that clause is in there for any other reason than the amount of compensation offered is inadequate, the reason that language is in there is the legislature clearly wanted people to understand we have two phases here to an eminent domain case. This deals with the taking one, and we don't want people to think that they have to come in and bring the compensation one at that point.
Dealing with the taking is more than just does the state have the power to do it. It's whether the state not only has the power to do it, which it has here,
right,
but it has to do it properly under 32.05.
Well, they procedurally followed all the steps.
That's right.
To perfect the taking.
Exactly.
I would agree with that.
All right.
I would agree with that.
Hirschdorf, there are five parcels here.
Yep.
Suppose all of those 150 acres were in one parcel. Would the state's analysis be correct under those circumstances?
Well, That's why I think the Spiegelberg facts present an interesting situation and why we offer that, the clingy appraisal. And mind you, the appraisals that we offered as exhibits here were appraisals that were done by the state. We didn't do appraisals that were done by condominiums. These were done, ones that were done at the behest of the Department of Transportation. Let's assume that this was one large tax parcel of 150 acres. I still believe in that circumstance that you would still look at a piece of land that's physically cut off by a road, like we saw in the Klingy case. That's accepted appraisal methodology. And likewise, I think you would also look at the two tax parcels, 4 and 5, that are clearly wetlands, that those could be looked at differently. Now, the state, in their reply brief, also cited a passage from ALR 4th, which talked about when something is used for agricultural purposes, then subdivisions are ignored. I went back and read that whole ALR treatise. It's long. But what that whole section, that's over 100 pages, what it deals with is really two concepts. One is the subdivision issue, which the state argued at length, which I don't think even applies. We aren't even arguing about the subdivision. But there's a lot of that in the state's brief. But a lot of these cases talk about the subdivision concept and also what I call the Jonas rule. And that is that the attempt by an owner to try and consolidate separate parcels that are not contiguous. The example I use is the restaurant on one side of the road and the parking lot on the other side of the road. And the taking takes the parking lot, and the owner tries to argue that that creates severance on the restaurant itself, severance damages. One of the justices, I think, asked a counsel for the state something about that effect. I forget who it was, but that's precisely why the attempt of all that, of talking about having severance damages in and including that, is that what the owner is trying to do is trying to claim some damages against that parcel that wasn't affected because of its relationship to the other one. But the Jonas rule, I think this went to the question about the jury instruction. The jury instruction addresses and deals with the Jonas rule. It doesn't deal with our situation here. Basically, that jury instruction is for the purposes of providing guidance when you have two separate parcels that an owner wants to bring together because that owner wants to assert some severance damages against a parcel that was not directly affected by the taking.
This statute, 32096,
right.
What does whole property mean?
That's what you'll be deciding here today.
Well, you tell me.
Well, I believe the whole part, basically, when you combine that with the most advantageous use, it's basically, and the liberal construction rule that is cited in Standard Theaters, which applies to the entire Chapter 32, it basically says we look at it from what's most advantageous from the property owner's perspective. And so what we're saying is that the smallest legal subdivision that exists here is the tax parcel. It wasn't established by Bernice Spiegelberg. She didn't go out and do some kind of a sham or anything else. This was already established by the governmental authorities, and therefore, and it's a legal description, it's able to be sold, transferred, whatever, just like a CSM, just like a lot. We're saying if that's more advantageous for the property owner to be able to value it that way, then that should be the larger parcel. In other words, the larger parcel should be consistent with what's most advantageous.
But if there was only one parcel,
right?
Is that the whole property in the statute?
You're talking about if there was just one tax parcel of 150 acres? It would, except if this court, and I believe the court, if you're going to enunciate some rule, should also take into account, let's assume we had 150 acres, pardon me, had 150 acres under one tax parcel. I do think any rule that this court enunciates should also address the situation that we saw in Klingy, and it should also address the situation that we saw in Servant, where back parcels with clearly a different use were sold off or could be sold off separately. I think that needs to be addressed and should not be prohibited because clearly the marketplace recognizes that as a distinction for valuation. On the other hand, let's just assume we take one of these tax parcels that exist right now, and I, or Bernice Spiegelberg, attempted to say that the larger parcel is going to be something less than that tax parcel. Then I think we, as the landowner, the condominee, has the burden of showing that that subpart of that tax parcel fits into whatever exception you might have, the exceptions that I think should apply. And the two that are obvious to me are two separate uses. For instance, let's say we've got a 20-acre parcel. The front 5 acres are being operated for a commercial use. The back 15 acres are being rented out to some neighboring farmer. But the taking only affects the front 5 acres. I believe that there could be a finding that there should, that the larger parcel would only relate to the front 5 acres, but it's not going to be automatically bestowed upon the property owner in that situation. The property owner would have a burden of showing that.
Mr. Beerstar, when you argue to me sort of general principles of what is fair for the property owner, I'm receptive to what you're saying, but it seems to me the court has to interpret what is meant by the statute.
Right.
Is this statute making Wisconsin different from other states? Or, I mean, we've got to have some rational concept of what whole property is.
Right.
And it seems to me it would be troublesome to me if we just started adding on more and more conditions, however reasonable they might be. Please react.
Well, first of all, as I think we stated in our brief, and the state may have even also said that as well, is that this is a case of first impression anywhere. This issue has not been addressed in any jurisdiction that we can find anywhere in this country, period. So we're getting it for the first time. But what we're talking about here, when you're talking about whole parcel, the statute doesn't address it. We really can't find any case law that specifically addresses it. So it's not like we're changing the statute or we're modifying or anything else. We're really addressing this issue for the first time. Why it's taken this long to happen, I don't know. But we are addressing this for the first time. That's really what we're dealing with here.
Let me ask you this question. I assume that you wouldn't question the need for the state to develop highways, good operating highways, and the need to take land.
Absolutely.
Give me the policy reason why, in taking this land for this important purpose, the state should pay $84,600 rather than $18,900. What's the policy reason we should do that? These people have to pay for it.
Yeah, well, all the taxpayers have to pay for it. I agree with it. It's a matter of, but it shouldn't look as who has to pay for it. It's what is the proper method of valuation in this particular situation. If this land really could be sold in that way, and that's exactly what the Kielish appraisal was all about, is that this land could be sold by these individual parcels, then why shouldn't it be valued that way? Because that's exactly how Bernice Spiegelberg would be able to sell the land. She's just entitled to receive fair market value for the most advantageous way that she could sell the land. Remember, we don't have an actual sale, so we have to kind of hypothesize. In this particular case, Mr. Kielish opined that because there were other small residential developments around, that would be the way that the property would get sold, and therefore she should get the benefit of that, because that's how the land is most valuable in this neighborhood.
Justice Prosser is saying, you look at the statute, it talks about whole property.
Mm-hmm.
And then the state uses Nichols on eminent domain, which I'm sure you've looked at.
Oh, yeah.
And they say all parcels of real property, whether contiguous or non-contiguous, that are in substantially identical ownership, that's what we have here, and are being used or are reasonably suitable for use in reasonably foreseeable future. Well, that may be for their highest and best use as an integrated economic unit, must be treated as if the entire parcel constituted a single parcel. And that's the state. They say, look, this is the way whole property, that's what we're talking about here. So why should we treat that any different?
Well, first of all, you have to remember, Nichols and Eminent Domain is a reporting service. So what they're doing is they're reporting on cases, and they're basically saying or enunciating rules that are from a case. If you look at the underlying cases on all of these Nichols sites, they address the Jonas situation. They all address Jonas. Basically is that if you have...
Single parcel, multiple owners.
No, single owner, multiple parcels, but basically what the passage in Nichols is talking about is you have the situation where you have the restaurant with the parking lot across the street. Nichols' rule is addressing the fact situation. It says those should be brought together and treated as one because that's most advantageous to the property owner. That gives the most advantageous use and recognizes the highest damages for the property owner, which is basically what the Standard Theater's rule is all about.
And that gets me back to my quandary. I mean, this case comes to us in a, you shake your head and say, I know, in a difficult way. Here it is, the morning of trial. The jury's on their way in. There's a motion in limine, and the motion in limine is to limit you, the motion is brought by the state, and it is to limit you from arguing or presenting evidence to the jury asserting the calculation of the value of the property at issue herein based upon the existence of hypothetical subdivisions of such property. That's the motion, the words of the motion. So the judge listens to you all, in my opinion, quite briefly, gives an opinion that I already read that's awfully brief, and then the jury comes in. And then the record reflects, he says, wait a minute, there's a conference in chambers. And then the next thing you come out, and you end up having a stipulation as to damages, because there's no evidence to present on the other side. And you have offers of proof, but it's not as though the court accepted anything into evidence. These appraisals are here as offers of proof only. And the court arrived at the amount of $84,000 not on assessing what was the, as the statute says, the most advantageous use, not even addressing that issue. The party stipulated $84,000. He signed, the party stipulated $84,000. It's $84,000. So that's it. That's our record. There's no evidence off that's received. There's no rationale regarding most advantageous use. I sit here and I listen to your argument, and I say, sounds to me like maybe this could be developed in the future, just around the corner, and it would be good stuff and she could get more. And after all, this statute is to be liberally construed in favor of your client.
Right.
As to compensation.
As to compensation, that's right. So, you're kind of halfway home. You're on first base. You're not a home run yet, but with that maxim of interpretation. But we don't have anything in the record regarding the most advantageous use. There was no hearing about it. There was no evidence about it. There was no ruling about it. And yet that's what you're arguing, that, she'd be better off if she could develop this and sell it. And that's my problem.
Well, I understand that. And it's partly because of what you're addressing right now why I put that passage in our papers, because I can certainly see the court having a question about that.
Okay. Suppose this was going back. Or you don't have to suppose that. We're giving a ruling that's going to cover future cases, right? That's what you're asking for.
Well, I think that's what this court's going to do, whether I ask for it or not. But.
All right. I don't care which way we do it. Now, here's my question. You were on the court, and you were writing it. What would you write?
State the question again, please.
If you were on this court, and you were writing, what does 32096 mean when you have multiple tax parcels owned by one person? What's the rule for evaluating the fair market value before and after? Or, and I gather that's what you're fighting about, because you're not doing the fair market value of the property taken, right?
We reserve that depending on how this court ruled, right?
Okay. So, what's the rule that we're so smart that we're going to do that you think works?
Well, Your Honors, I've got to be honest with you. I think the rule would be one where this Court would recognize the smallest legal division that's possible, whether it's a CSM, a subdivision, or a tax parcel, provided that there was an inquiry into the highest and best use and that that subdivision was consistent with that highest and best use. And I guess I would also like to think that that rule should also address and recognize that the whole parcel could be something less than that smallest legal subdivision if there was a physical separation or division of that property, such as we experienced in the Klinge case, if, again, it could be shown that the highest and best use warranted that type of a subdivision.
Let me see if I understand what you're saying, because I'm going to rephrase it. Where you have multiple parcels owned by one person and used for one purpose, that you will value that those parcels either as a unit or separately to determine the fair market value of the whole, depending on what is the highest and best use, which would might mean a use not presently by the owner, but within a reasonable time or foreseeable future, and it's not speculative. So you might say here, if it's reasonable and not speculative, that in the immediate future, this is going to be used for a residential development or parts thereof, you're going to value these five in that way. If in the foreseeable future it's going to be used as agricultural and that's the highest and best use, you're going to value them that way. And then you're going to do the same valuation after the acreage is taken, and the subtraction between the two is what you get. Is that the same thing as you said?
I think that's fair, and I think this is kind of what the ALR discussion was going, the state addressed, and in fact I'm going to, I'll show another one here that I think is kind of pertinent on this particular point, and that is that what that discussion in ALR talked about was where the highest and best use was agricultural, the parcels were going to be treated as lumped together, all consolidated. Whereas if it's for a different use, then you would look upon the lot lines, subdivisions, or whatever other physical subdivisions existed, and you're going to have to depend, and it's going to be evaluated in each particular case. And I guess I have to be honest and say I think that probably is a correct way that it should probably be done.
Then you'll go along with what Nichols said in what Justice Wilcox read.
Well, no, I don't agree with what Nichols says, because, like I say, all those passages in Nichols address the Jonas situation. They don't really address this situation.
Okay.
There is no passage anywhere. I mean, I look high and low. There is no passage anywhere that addresses this situation that is facing this court today.
Well, what about this? I mean, I don't care. You might be right. I haven't checked the citations. If an owner of land wishes to assert that the land being taken is not at the present time being used at its highest potential, which is what your client is trying to do, it is incumbent upon the condemnee to establish this fact, right? The courts, however, have developed various limitations on the practice. The ultimate goal of the limitations placed upon establishing a higher and better use of the land, thus raising the ultimate value of the land being taken, is to avoid mere speculation or conjecture and uncertainty. Won't you go along with that?
Yeah, there's not a problem with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. where the land is pure raw land, where no improvements at all have been made, and there was a showing of adaptability for subdivision purposes, which is what you're trying to do, valuation will generally be on the whole subdivision basis. The real problem arises when the condition of the land is neither in these two extreme states, but where it's unclear as to how long it's going to take.
But now all those passages address the subdivision
method,
which we're not talking about here.
No, but you are talking about potentially development of parts of this land.
I have no question that the potential buyer or the reasonable buyer of each of these tax parcels, not necessarily 4 and 5, but 1, 2, and 3, I have no question that the person buying that parcel is going to subdivide that parcel. But we're not valuing it on that basis. You know, that's not our valuation theory here.
Well, what is your valuation theory? The appraiser goes through how many lots could be made.
No. He does not do that.
Well, what does he do?
He just basically looks at the tax parcels themselves.
Okay.
And goes out and finds comparable sales of similar size that had been used for similar residential development purposes.
But based on similar residential purposes.
Well, the ones that were sold were the person buying them and ultimately subdivided it.
Right, that's what I'm trying to say.
Not doing a subdivision analysis.
Well, he's not saying there'll be 50 lots and each lot's worth 4,000.
No.
He's not saying that, but he's saying someone's going to buy it. He's going to buy it on the supposition that you're going to subdivide this. That will be expenses, et cetera, and therefore the net cost of a reasonable buyer or the net price of a reasonable buyer will be X. That's what he's doing.
Well, again, that doesn't enter into the analysis here. This sale that we're talking about here is just, for instance, a sale of a 20-acre tract that the developer buys. He just buys it, just like you and I would buy a residential lot.
But he's going to pay more for it if it can be then subdivided and sold.
Right, but we're not looking into a subdivision analysis in determining the value.
Clearly, if we're going to get into this, my concern was when you've got parcels 4 and 5, which talk about wetland, and my difficulty was, and you're not talking about subdivision, as I understand your argument, just so I understand it, you're saying, well, we have this, quote, alleged legal subdividing of land. It's the parcel, individual description. It's the tax parcel. And you're saying that it is not under not the Jonas, but under the ALR, is that they should really look at the parcel that is where the road is running through rather than to be using all of the land owned by one person, taking, you know, everything into account and then coming up with one value. In other words, that's what the state is saying. That's what the unit rule means. You look at everything owned by this one person, and then you take... It's simple. You divide the number of acres, and then you come up with a value. Your argument, your argument is not. That's what the state is saying.
Yeah, but remember, that's not the unit rule. That's not the classic unit rule.
No, that's what they're saying, as I understand the argument of your opposing counsel.
Right. No, that is what they're saying. We're saying it's not the unit rule. But what we're saying is basically, it's unfortunate the use of the word subdivision is here, because what we have here is we have a pre-existing division of the farm. It's not a subdivision. It's not a platted subdivision. We just have a pre-existing legal division that is identified by the various tax parcels. And so what we're just saying is that you just take each of those tax parcels, and if you've got a 40-acre parcel, you go out and you find other 40-acre parcels that have similar highest and best use, and determine the value.
Which is for residential purposes.
Yeah, that's the case, right, which in this case it was.
It just seemed to me I was concerned, not say, because I'm not sure where we're going to go with this case, but I was concerned about how you can look at wetlands in the same light that you can look at property that is not a wetland. That's what I was looking at when you use all five of them together.
Right, that's why I'm saying in this particular case, even if you had all five parcels, even if this is one big tax parcel, it may very well be appropriate with this particular taking. We would have a burden in this circumstance, however, But the property owner, if they could establish that the wetlands really would be treated separately.
Well, I was thinking about if there was a beautiful lake on one part and the rest was not.
Right.
It defies common sense to say, well, it's all one and the lake is worth no more than the other part. That just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's an indication or an instance where you're being fronting on water, if you will, is actually more valuable. Again, if it's all one big tax parcel, I would not argue with the court saying that we have the burden to show that. I would just hope that the court would at least allow a property owner to establish that burden and not just automatically cut it off.
Justice Bradley has a question.
Yes, just thank you, Chief. It seems to me a lot of our focus has been on sub 6 in the case of a partial taking, and yet as I hear your argument, you're almost leading with sub 2. That is, what is the most advantageous use? And if it's the most advantageous use in this kind of a fact where you already have 5 separate parcels, if it's the most advantageous use to treat it as a whole, either now or within the reasonable short future, then that's the way you treat it. If it's the most advantageous use, either now or within the reasonable future, you use it 5 ways, that's the way you treat it. And so your definition of whole, really, that is how you treat these parcels as 1 or 5, is really driven by what's the most advantageous use.
That's correct.
You start with sub 2 to find out what parts you're going to use here or the whole.
Well, I think we have to because the sub 6 doesn't address the whole. It doesn't define it. Mm-hmm. And so we have to look somewhere else for guidance. And I believe that sub 2, where we're supposed to be looking for the most advantageous use in the standard theater's rule, it says we're supposed to give the benefit of the doubt and be a liberal construction for the property owner is what, in this particular situation, I believe allows for the 5 parcels being treated as they were, even in this case. We've had this discussion, Your Honor, back and forth about highest and best use. But in this particular case, I believe that Judge Hawley still can be affirmed when we look at it that way. Now, the court may disagree with that, but I'm here to say that I think that we can still affirm it. But my answers I gave earlier were in trying to address a general rule that this court may wish to apply for others that are wanting to look beyond this single case.
Counsel,
yes.
Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Hunter, I gave opposing counsel the opportunity to write the opinion. You have the same opportunity. How would you write the opinion?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, if I may, I'd just like to correct one what appears to be a misunderstanding. Justice Wilcox, you indicated that essentially it was like there would be a percentage sort of thing. We'd figure out how much on a per acre basis and apply it across the board.
What I was trying to compare was your answer with opposing counsel as far as you want to treat it as one parcel. He's suggesting we treat it as 5 parcels. And I was only saying that when you do it that way, some parcels are worth more than others. Nothing about a percentage.
Well, Your Honor, but what you said in your, my understanding anyway, of what you had said was that DOT is essentially going to take the value of this and then essentially apply the person, more or less a percentage or
I feel there were 150 acres. If the way I understand, there are 150 acres. You're taking 11 acres. So whatever it would be, you get a value for the 150, and then you're taking 11 of the 150.
Yes, Your Honor, but the determination of how much the value is to the condominee is not essentially a flat fee of a percentage or a per acre price based on the 150. It's on essentially a difference between the before and after.
Yes.
In terms of what the court should do, Your Honor, the court, I believe, has to go back to what is the unit rule. What the plaintiffs, the respondent in this case, is suggesting is that the court make a determination that, well, okay, if it's in the if if the condominee gets more money, and we have to look at what is the most advantageous use. That's not what they were talking about. What they were talking about is whether or not, in terms of for the benefit of the condominee, whether she gets more money by cranking numbers one way versus cranking the numbers another way. If all things being equal, what the unit rule says is that you must apply across the board this determination. The property which is to be acquired is to be examined to determine whether or not there is unity of use, ownership, and of contiguity.
Here's my problem, Mr. Hunter.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's say I agree with the state. We're going to look at all five parcels together. But in looking at all five parcels together, I'm going to say, I think, if I were the appraiser, looking at them together, some are going to be marsh, and I can't do anything with them under the DNR. Some is going to be wooded land, which is very pretty, but quite hilly and not buildable, but is an asset. And I'll assess that's 20 acres, and I'll say, well, that's worth blank. The marshland is 40 acres or whatever it is, and that has aesthetic value, and that's worth blank. But then I got another lot of land, lots of land here that have potential value as building, and that may be X number of acres, and some of it is large lots, some of it's small lots, so that's each going to be worth whatever. And then I've got some land that might soon be commercial because it's going to be sitting on the highway. It's not going to have very much value as residential land, but it will have potentially commercial if there's access. And that's worth Z. So I've looked at the whole property, all 150 acres, and I'm not looking at the tax parcels, but I'm looking at the nature of the 150 acres, and I'm adding it all together. And I'm getting a figure. Is that how we should do it?
Essentially, yes.
What difference does it make whether it's a tax parcels or not? We're looking at the whole, but we're dividing it up so there isn't $1 figure for each acre or for each quarter of an acre or whatever it is.
Your Honor, what you're talking about is essentially what I was, I believe, saying before, in that property, when it is properly valued, is the value of the property is determined by the contribution of each element, whether or not those elements happen to correspond to tax parcels or legal lines or whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, nobody knows. But each element can be assessed as a value. That does not, however, give the trial court and should not give this court the direction to essentially add them all up, and then have the jury do that adding up and make a value.
But I did. I added them up, and you're not objecting.
No, Your Honor.
I didn't add them up by tax parcel, but I added them up by the nature of
Either
the land to make a whole.
Land to make a whole.
You agree that's okay. Will it be different? Will I reach a different result than the assessor, than the appraiser for the condominee in this case?
I believe you would, Your Honor. And the real difficulty that the court faces here, and what the court must keep in mind, is that when one values a property as a whole, the unit rule, as I was saying before, requires that essentially the value of the whole cannot be exceeded by the value of its parts. This Court has said so several times, Green Bay Broadcasting being one. And if you give to the jury the job of making a determination as to the value of the entirety of the property, that the elements of that calculus, of that determination, cannot be put in such a way such that the value of those different elements can exceed the value of the whole fee. That's, I think, the difficulty that we're dealing with here. And in that context, I believe that the Court should refer to its language in Green Bay, in which it indicates that condominees are constitutionally entitled to just compensation, But contracts between the owners of different interests in the land, and in this case we're not dealing with contracts, but basically just different elements, contracts between the owners of different interests in the land should not be permitted to result in a total sum which is in excess of the value of the whole of the undivided fee. That's the danger of going in the direction of having jury instructions, which would require a juror to essentially add up this value and that value and this value separately, determine the value of the land, and then determine the value of the whole separately. The value of the whole under 3209 is one number. What is the before and what is the after? The difference is the value that is to be paid as just compensation.
We all agree this is under 3209, not 3205. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you use the Radiman case to say anything else?
No, Your Honor. What I said with regard to Radiman was essentially that the Court really should be aware, and the reason I cited it was that the Court should be aware that it has, in fact, rendered a determination sort of like this in another case. It came up in a different way. We did 3205 was not brought up in the context of this proceeding, but that determination was made in Radiman that the parcels, you have multiple owners and multiple parcels, one parcel was the taking.
Counselor, that's just not what Radiman says. I beg to differ, and I thought you and I agreed before. In Radiman, it said that issue could not be looked at because it was not timely raised. There was no decision by the Court of Appeals that said it was proper to treat three parcels owned by two people, one owning one, the other two, as one parcel.
Correct, Your Honor. I did not intend to convey that the Court had made a determination that was correct. So what I'm saying is that there were multiple parcels, and there were multiple owners, and ultimately the result was that it was treated as one.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. I want to thank Assistant Attorney General Hunter and Attorney Beersdorf for their arguments today. Now, we have a motion here, and the State's brief, the objection was to the State's brief at 10:11 as a raising a separate issue, and that was the Radiman case. Is that correct? Okay. And you say that the Radiman case is just presented as an analogous, something that we could do as an analogy. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, I presented the Radiman case. I had, in my prior brief, I had referred to it and cited it.
Thank
and
you.
Just wrote the report to that.
And you responded to that here. Is that right? And you asked to be given an opportunity to respond in writing, but you responded here to Radiman. Is that correct?
Yes, I did in the papers, yes.
And here an oral argument.
Yes,
also.
I guess I
okay. Thank you. Do you think we're done with that issue?
I guess it depends on whether the Court wants to address. I just feel that the decision was improperly applied to 3205.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel, and that motion is under advisement, if you still are making it, counsel.
Yes, I think it's important.
Thank you. That concludes our argument in 04-AP-3384, Spiegelberg versus State and Department of Transportation. The Court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. When we have oral argument, the Court will meet in closed session at 3:30 promptly. We are in recess.